Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Manny.
And it's time for another Secret Wars Saturday. So this is a part of our Marvel chronology project. We decided to start with Secret Wars, but a complete Secret Wars. So starting with the first miniseries back in the 80s. But then we decided to go back even a little further and do all the prologues or tie-ins or whatever you want to call them. In the few months leading up to Secret Wars. And we actually found the Secret War reading order on a site called the Comic Book Herald. There's a link in the show notes if you want to go and check it out. And I think after these two that we'll talk about today, there's two more. There's one more Avengers and there's a Thing issue. And then we'll be into the Marvel Superhero Secret Wars maxi series 12-issue limited series itself. So I know Manny's anxious to get to the main event, but I think it's been interesting reading these titles that lead up to it because it gives you kind of a window into the comics that were coming out at that time. I know you said one of the comics you had that we're going to talk about tonight, you have a lot to say about. The other you don't have much to say about. You said it was bad, didn't like it, so I find that interesting. I actually enjoyed both. So let's start with Captain America number 292. Cover date April 1984. The writer is J.M. DeMatteis. So I think DeMatteis is probably most known for his run on Justice League in the early 90s, but you know, he still does work even today, so he's been around for a long time. The pencils in this issue are by Paul Neary. The inks are by Ed Barreto, and the colors are by Bob Sharon. So let's just talk about the cover, first of all. I really like the cover, actually. It's pretty dynamic. You can see the city of New York in the background. Looks like Cap is fighting this character, this Indian-looking character on the Brooklyn Bridge. Kind of get the idea that his name is the Black Crow, based on the cover title there, Beware the Black Crow. So right from the start, like it's going to be a lot of action in this book. And I feel like this cover and even the corner box with the way Cap's kind of in an action pose, it really is pretty typical of the kind of stories that DeMatteis was telling in Captain America around this time. Good characterization, kind of some long plot threads like we've talked about in the past in these 80s books, but a lot of action. So overall, I thought this was a pretty interesting story. Again, like I said, with plot threads that go throughout these books, there's a few throwbacks in here, a few mentions of Cap talking about being attacked by this, what he feels is a giant, kind of supernatural, creepy, giant crow. And it flashes back to Cap to 90, to 80, where he's feeling like something's going on. And then we learn that this crow is actually an American Indian who was working as a construction worker on skyscrapers, fell off, became crippled. And he has these blackouts where he's transformed into this crow and later into this Black Crow kind of superhero. And apparently he's kind of personifying the spirit of America, apparently, the ancient spirit of America. And he wants revenge on the current embodiment of America because he feels like the quote-unquote white man kind of persecuted the Native Americans. Which we all know to be true. But that's his reasoning for attacking Captain America in the story. It's also set around Christmas time, and DeMatteis takes that into account with some Christmas shopping and Christmas parties and things like that. So showing Steve Rogers kind of in an everyday kind of thing gets into his advertising job a little bit. So I kind of feel like it's kind of typical of what DeMatteis was doing with Cap at the time, kind of showing these different sides to him. As far as the resolution to the story itself, I guess you can kind of get out of it what you put into it. You know, Cap is his usual preachy self to some extent and doesn't understand why this Black Crow character is attacking him. And then when Black Crow kind of mentions the things that I talked about, Cap's kind of like, well, you know, we're doing the best we can. And, you know, I fight for everyone equally and kind of things like that. And in the end, he bows, he kneels down in front of Black Crow, I guess, as a sign of respect. And apparently that pleases the spirit that kind of embodies Black Crow or gives Black Crow's powers. And that's it. And then the story just kind of ends. So it's kind of interesting. I think I remember Black Crow showing up again later in the Captain America title, but I can't say for sure when. But overall, it's an enjoyable story. It's kind of a lighter story. It's not, you know, some of the stories that Damon Tayus was telling at the time, like I said, they were plots that were planted in previous issues. And you see that here too. You know, this is kind of the resolution of one of the plot threads he had running through. As I mentioned, there's Cap talks about how it's been happening for a while. This Black Crow, he feels like, is always kind of at the edge of his vision, spying on him. And he doesn't, you know, he knows something's going on, but he doesn't really understand completely. So Damon Tayus did have these threads that were running throughout the title. This certainly isn't like a major thread. And so this doesn't necessarily feel like a major story, but there were other plot threads and other storylines going on that were of more importance and felt like they were more significant. So, you know, it's not the most important or the most impactful issue, but I found it enjoyable. As far as the Secret Wars tie-in, it's really just an afterthought, you know, after the main story, which absolutely has nothing to do with the Secret Wars at all. There's kind of a, and it even says at the top of the page, epilogue. And it shows that kind of advanced science-y looking construct in Central Park. It shows the Avengers there. Thor, the female Captain Marvel, the one that could turn herself into light. Captain America, Vision, Mockingbird, Scarlet Witch, Hawkeye, Star Fox, and apparently She-Hulk's there too, although she's not in the middle panel, only the bottom one. Anyway, these 10 Avengers show up to investigate this construct, and 6 of them enter and disappear. And we get the blurb at the bottom, to be continued in Marvel Superhero Secret Wars number 1 on sale soon. And again, it's only 6 of them that disappear. So Captain America, Hawkeye, She-Hulk, Wasp, Thor, and Captain Marvel. Apparently, Starhawk, Scarlet Witch, Vision, and Mockingbird weren't important enough to put in Secret Wars. I really don't know what the thought was behind who they chose to go to the Battle Zone planet. But like I said, completely an afterthought, completely just kind of thrown in. It even says in the middle panel, see Avengers 242 for the full details. So I guess they wanted to just throw this in here so that people that were reading Captain America knew something about the Secret Wars, because obviously when the next issue comes out, that's going to be Captain America having returned from Secret Wars, and they're probably going to make a mention of it. So yeah, it's a pretty clunky way to do it, but I guess it caused us to read the book anyway. So I know you didn't really care for this title that much, Maddie. Let me hear what you had to say.
No, I felt kind of, it's kind of on the lines that you're talking about. I felt kind of cheated with the tie-in for Secret Wars. Like, if you rip out that page, you know, it's still the same book pretty much.
Oh yeah.
So that made it interesting. You know, the biggest problem I had with it, and I know it sounds really nitpicky and strange, but the resolution of the issue was the thing I had a problem with. Because you talked already about why, the reasons why Black Crow is upset, and how he's fighting the current American spirit in Captain America, the embodiment of America, and of course he's the classic Native American. First of all, let me mention that you probably can't write this comic in this day and age. It's not it wouldn't pass, I think, PC. And that's kind of a shame. It was pretty good. I don't understand the panel, the one panel where, he says, and he knows what must be done. And then he kneels down to him and he's like, you kneel. And then like directly after, like he has this, almost the panel makes it look like he's maniacally laughing. And that's what I had a problem with, because so I thought he was going to go out and gloat or something, a speech or anything. But then the very next panel, he picks him up and he hugs him. I was like, oh, all right. That works, because he sees it as an apology. I don't know. I think if you leave out that one panel, this is a whole different book for me.
Which, the one panel where he's laughing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could kind of get that. Like, what? Okay, is he laughing out of genuine, like, respect, or?
I don't know, because the way it's drawn, like, the way, like, you know, even the hand gestures, it really makes it look like he's more maniacally laughing than anything else. Like, I bested you. Like, I...
Spoken like a true Batman fan. You've too much joke in your life, my friend.
Yeah, well, I don't like it.
While you were talking, I did look up Black Crow, and I... so he next actually appears in Captain America 299 and 300. So just seven issues later, then in Daredevil 225, Marvel Fanfare 39, Doctor Strange 25, Quasar 23, Spectacular Spider-Man 191 and 193, Spectacular Spider-Man Annual 13, Captain America 440 and 443, then not seen again until he returned in Civil War, that first Civil War, 6 and 7. So those last, the last time he appeared was January 2007. So it's been 10 years. But it was a good 13 years that he kind of appeared sporadically. I just kind of take it to be that, you know, Captain America kneeling was like an apology.
And I thought it was good. Like that's totally a Captain America thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, if he didn't need to fight, he wasn't going to. And I thought that was done really well. I just didn't really enjoy too much of the Steve Rogers personal life stuff. It was, I don't know. I just found it, I get it. You know, you want to have a complete character, but for me, I just don't care enough about Captain America to really want to get into it.
Yeah. And I honestly wonder how much I would enjoy this if I was reading it for the first time, because Captain America was a title I read, like, I think from like the John Byrne issues in like the 240s, like all the way up through, I can't even remember when I stopped reading, like up through 400, up past 400. So I read it like every, so when I go back and read this, like I've read this before way back when it first came out, you know, read it off the newsstand in 1984. Awesome. So there's a little bit of nostalgia for me when I read these titles, and I'll talk more about that when we talk about Iron Man.
Can I ask you a couple of questions then?
Yeah, go ahead.
So how much, like as you're reading these titles, how much about what was going to happen in Civil War did you know? I mean, sorry, Secret Wars.
Oh, I remember Secret Wars 100%.
I know. No, but like as these, so the issues.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So at the time, I didn't know anything. It was a different world back then. Like there wasn't even Wizard Magazine. Like when Wizard Magazine came out, that was like, you know, in the 91, I think was the first issue, mid 91, September 91, maybe somewhere around there. And that was like a big thing, because all of a sudden now you got news and you knew about what upcoming stuff. I mean, there was Comic Buyer's Guide and Comic Shop News before that and everything, but it wasn't to the same extent that like everybody read Wizard, and that was like the first time that you really could get news. It's nothing like it is today, you know, with the internet and instant information, social media, you know what's going on, you know, months ahead of time. Back then you really couldn't get that much from the solicits, you know. You read the solicits 2 months ahead of time, but it really didn't tell you that much about the story. They were super vague. It was like reading your horoscope, you know. It didn't really tell you anything. You could kind of read into it if you were following the title and maybe kind of get something out of it. But yeah, all I knew about Secret Wars, reading these titles and seeing that, you know, that iconic image of all the heroes was, man, this is going to be a title that has all these heroes in one book. And for me back then, that was like, that was it. You know, like my budget was limited. I was just a kid. Part of the reason I was such a big Legion of Superheroes fan was that, okay, so I can buy one book and it has like all these heroes. So I definitely will do that, right? I bought a lot of team books just based on the fact I felt like I was getting more bang for my buck because I had more heroes in it. So, you know, Avengers, G.I. Joe, because it had a lot of characters, Legion of Superheroes, Justice League. I bought all those titles because, you know, multiple characters. I could not wait for Secret War. I was like, what is this going to be about? Had absolutely no idea, but was in. Because again, if you don't have any idea what Secret Wars is about, again, there's no marketing, you know, it was a different world. It wasn't like they were teasing what it was going to be about. So you really didn't have any idea. You just knew that it was going to be like all these characters, and I was in, you know. I was like, yeah, I can't wait to buy it, can't wait to read it. But if you go back and you read, like we are, these prologues, no part of any book that we've read is a prologue that ties in or whatever you want to call it. There's nothing in any of those tie-ins that really tells you anything about what the story is, other than there's some energy that's really powerful that causes Professor X pain or can blow up Avengers computers. But what is, I mean, that could be anything, right? Could be anything. Like, and what does that title mean? Like Secret Wars, like no clue. And we hadn't seen any of the, pretty much it was just like this last page you see, this iconic image was pretty much the only image that we'd seen. And at no point was it hinted that there was going to be a group of villains that were transported to Battle World as well. Like, no idea what the story was about whatsoever. And I think that there was maybe a little bit of news that came out. And maybe if I had been older and, you know, a little more sophisticated and wasn't just buying my, I mean, I was just buying my comics off the spinner rack, you know, or at 7-Eleven. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't old enough to drive. I didn't live in a town that had a comic shop. So maybe if that had been the case, I might have known a little more, because I think there was an issue of Marvel Age that came out before Secret Wars actually hit that gave some hints about what it was about. But I wasn't aware of that at the time. So yeah, reading these books, and I mean, the reason I picked up Secret Wars was just based on this house ad that was showing up everywhere. You know, Ultimate 12-issue limited series begins this January. Don't miss it. I was like, yeah, I'm in. I can't wait. And I bought every single issue off the newsstand, and it was awesome. There had to be
quite the excitement for you seeing, you know, some Avengers, Fantastic Four, X-Men. I mean, so many different groups finally coming together.
Well, yeah. So that was the thing. Like, there were some of the characters, like when I first started reading it, that I didn't know that well. Like, I wasn't even though I said I was a big fan of team books, for whatever reason, I never got into the X-Men. I never really read X-Men. So this was really my first exposure to them was seeing them in Secret Wars. Like, I vaguely knew who they were, but it wasn't until after Secret Wars that I started picking up X-Men. And the other thing that's interesting when you look at this, and I'll have to go back and look at find some other instances of this cover, because Kitty Pryde is on here and she doesn't actually go to the planet, which is interesting. I just noticed that right now. She's right there just below Nightcrawler and above Cyclops to the left of Rogue, but she doesn't go. So that's interesting.
Oh, I wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah. Not everybody that goes is on here because there's no Reed Richards and there's no Professor Xavier, but it looks like everybody else is pretty much there. So yeah, at the time I didn't know anything that the story was about. But yeah, I do feel like reading this particular issue of Captain America, there may be a little bit of rose colored glasses just because there's some nostalgia there for me. The other thing about it is I really love the Paul Neary art. And the ink's by, I can't remember who, Ed Barreto. The inks are pretty good too, because part of the supernatural power or whatever that Black Crow has is he kind of can like bring this mystic fog kind of stuff, and it shrouds and protects other people from hearing or being able to see. And considering the like print process and coloring process back then, it's hard to do that without it looking just like bad printing. Like, oh, the printer was running out of ink. But they do a good job in here of that. And there's just little things that he does, like where he falls from the bridge and then stands up, how the star on the shield mirrors the star in his chest. The close-up on the mask. Yeah, there's just a lot. I think it's good, solid artwork. And Paul Neary is not a name that you hear a lot when you hear about some of the really high-quality art from the 80s. But there's a couple montage pieces in this that are really good as well. So I think the art, especially for the time, is done really, really well. The only thing I would say, and again, this is just a product of its time, the panel layouts are pretty boring. But this is how panel layouts were done back then. Everything was a rectangle or a square. And if it was a flashback, the boxes had rounded corners. That's how you could tell it was a flashback. So I can't really blame him for that. What did you think about the art? You didn't mention anything.
I liked it. And this is actually I looked at Iron Man first, and I wasn't really pleased with that book, the artwork in that book. And so going to this one, specifically the characters' faces, I thought those were done really, really well. And then also some of the first panels, I think it was the first full page with Captain America kind of crouched under his shield and that giant crow, like with the talon almost coming at him. I thought that was so done so beautifully. I really like that. Just good detail, good depth, just overall really, really good. He doesn't look too bulky or anything. Like it's just done really, really well. Looking at the book, I really enjoyed it. Like you were talking about the cover's done really well too. Just the way they're able to, I thought it was neat the way he's able to draw in that sky, that the city in the background without having to necessarily put too much work into it, too much detail, because you're so focused on the two figures, and it's done really well. So in that aspect, I really did enjoy it. I liked it a lot. Plus, it's cool to look at it close up and see all the dots, the color process, the way that these books are printed, so different from what obviously the way they're done today.
Oh yeah, old school for sure. Yeah, and I know. So the cover actually has the illustration on the cover actually has a date of 1983, but I know. You know, obviously the cover was done before, because I think this was January 1984. But it says Janssen on it, so I'm going to assume that's Klaus Janssen. Probably did the inks. I'm looking it up real fast. Let's see who did the... Ed Hannigan and Klaus Janssen. So Ed Hannigan was known for doing a lot of cover work at the time. So, all right, let's move on to the other Secret Wars tie-in that we're going to talk about tonight. And that is Iron Man, number 181, written by Denny O'Neill. Yes, that Denny O'Neill, mostly known for his work at DC on the Batman books and Nightwing and Robin and all that. Pencils are by Luke McDonnell. Inks by Steve Mitchell. And colors by Bob Sharon. Let's talk about the art first. So Luke McDonnell, pretty well-known comic artist from the 80s and early 90s, probably mostly known for this run of Iron Man, and he also was the artist on the Detroit era of the Justice League. So that's where Aquaman was originally the leader, and then he quit. But you had Martian Manhunter, you had Vibe, you had Steel, you had Vixen, Gypsy, which I think a lot of those characters are in the CW shows now, so that's kind of interesting. But it wasn't real popular. It was Justice League as B characters at best. Some would consider them C or D characters, but yeah, McDonald was known for that. Like, he handled that a good. He had a good 2 or 3 year run on Justice League when as it led up to Legends. Actually, it ended with the Legends miniseries, and then coming out of Legends, one of the titles that spun out of that miniseries was Suicide Squad. And this was the first Amanda Waller led Suicide Squad, if you will, or controlled Suicide Squad. This is when it was, taking the page from the Dirty Dozen, where let's get supervillains, let's put bombs on their wrist or in their heads or wherever, and get them to do our dirty work. And it's a black bag, secret government operation. Because up before that, if you've listened to the podcast in the past, when we've talked about Suicide Squad, we've talked about how it was more of a name for soldiers who didn't fit in anywhere else or were about to die or had terrible wounds and wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. So the introduction of Suicide Squad, as most people know it now, with supervillains having to be good guys, that series spun out of Legends, and that's where Luke McDonald went after Justice League ended. And he, again, had a really long run on that book. I feel like, there was a transition there in the late 80s and 90s in digital coloring and better paper quality. And as those things occurred, the art improved. Like, not the talents of the artists themselves, but their art was able to be more accurately portrayed. And so I feel like he's one of those artists that really benefited from that. Just because of his style, the more murky type of printing and color processing doesn't do his art any favors. I'll put it that way. That being said, he has a distinct style. And I know some people don't care for his style. His strength isn't in action. A lot of times his action poses look a little wonky. And he's never been my favorite artist. I've always just thought that his art was okay, but there every once in a while he'll do a close up on a face or just do a certain kind of splash page or whatever where I'd just be like, wow, that is really, really good. But for the most part, his art is serviceable but not great. He does, in contrast to what I just said about the last issue, we talked about Captain America and the panel layouts being pretty standard, McDonald does mess around with the panel layouts a little bit. He still uses, for the most part, rectangular panels, but he does kind of shift them around and play with them a lot more than a lot of his contemporary artists did. So there's times in this Iron Man issue where even though he's using rectangular panels, he kind of plays with the layout and kind of overlaps a little bit. There's even a scene where Iron Man's falling and he's got some vertical lines from all the way from the top of the page to the bottom panel that are basically showing the movement of Iron Man. It's almost like he's falling down the page. So he does have a good sense of style. And I think that shows in the way he lays out his pages. But his rendering itself could use a little work. And like I said, just his style is just not as clean or as polished as a lot of today's artists, I guess you'd say, and probably artists that Manny would enjoy. I will say that based on the inker, his art can look better or worse. There's some inkers that can make his art shine and some where, they're not doing him any favors. I'm not familiar with this inker, Steve Mitchell, but I think this is pretty standard of what Luke McDonald's art looks like most of the time. Later on in this run, up to Iron Man 200, Akins and Garvey, the inking team. And they're kind of known for like this time period. And they're the type of inkers who some artists didn't like to work with them because they felt like their inking style kind of took over and you couldn't even necessarily tell who the artist was. And so, you know, you kind of take it with a grain of salt. I know they worked on a few issues of ROM Space Knight. And I know it was always rumored. I know I don't know this for a fact, but it was always rumored that Sal Buscema, a legendary, you know, ROM artist, didn't like them on his book because he felt like it didn't look like his art. There was too much of their own sense of style and their own sense of the way things should look. But for McDonald, I think it, again, because it cleans it up a little bit because his art tends to be a little muddy. So I think that I like that. I actually like their style of inking, even over Buscema. You know, I'm a fan of theirs. They have a tendency to lighten line weights and, you know, just make things look a little smoother and cleaner. And that's a style of art I like. So, you know, but that's just me. As an artist, I could see if I felt like an inker was changing my style where it wasn't recognizable as me anymore. Yeah, that would probably bother me. But I think for McDonald, it works well. So I don't know if that's a compliment to Akin and Garvey or if that's a knock on McDonald. But yeah, that inking team is Ian Akin and Brian Garvey. Don't know if they're still around. Haven't seen their name on anything in a really long time. So what'd you think about the art on the book, Manny?
Yeah, like I was telling you, mentioning it, with the other book, I really didn't like it for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. Especially the way for me, the faces were a little too long in throughout the book. And then just some of the action shots, I just thought they were done. They're just weird. And it was a little bit distracting for me. But I was really into the book, but I wasn't really feeling the art. I wasn't feeling the character design as a Mandarin, and I don't know, just his face specifically in the helmet, it just looked very messy to me. And, it bugged me. So, and then specifically some of the faces in the middle of the book with Tony Stark and Gretel, like those to me are bad.
Yeah.
It felt a little, some of those middle panels felt really rushed. That's what it looked like. It looked like they were just quickly just done just to get through them. So, I really didn't care for the art.
I will have to give McConnell a pass on, or McDonald rather, a pass on the design of Mandarin. This is not his design of Mandarin. This is how Mandarin looked pretty much from the time he debuted until, I don't know, man, the early 2000s before they finally kind of updated him. But yeah, that is his costume with the loincloth and the tattoo and the helmet and cape. That is Silver Age goodness for you right there. And he made it all the way through the 70s without them.
He's a great character, like through the book. It was good, but like, I was like, couldn't take him seriously with that costume. It was like some weird combination between a Pharaoh, Animal Man, and Magneto. I don't know.
But the other thing is you didn't really get to see Mandarin at his, like when he's used well. Cause I mean, the whole thing about Mandarin is he has the 10 rings, right? And each ring does a different thing. And it's kind of cool. It's like a toolbox of powers and, you know, seeing him go against Iron Man and use different rings to try to do different things. And Iron Man uses different, you know, aspects of his armor to like combat what Mandarin's doing. We got none of that in this issue. He's got some crazy.
No, this is more. Yeah. It's like the final.
He's got some crazy technology, some crazy machine that's like destroying all the wheat in China. And it's just like, I don't remember the issue before this. So I can't even say if some of those classic Iron Man Mandarin fights with using the different powers of the rings even happened, in the previous issue. Cause I didn't go back and look at it. What I did do, because this is one of my favorite runs of Iron Man of all time. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, when you think of like classic Iron Man runs, the name Denny O'Neil doesn't usually pop up, right? Like that's not usually a name that people think of. But for whatever reason, again, and maybe it's just like looking at it with nostalgia leading up to, you know, issue 200. But, I loved this run of Iron Man, even though Tony Stark wasn't even in the armor. It was mostly Jim Rhodes until Tony returned to the armor in issue 200. But, yeah, it's I have such fond memories of this run that I couldn't just, like, read issue 181. I ended up reading 181 all the way up to 200. Like almost 20 issues. All these new comics that I have that I've never read that I need to read for to do this podcast or that podcast or whatever. And I spent a good almost 2 hours last night reading Iron Man. I could have kept going, to be honest with you. But I was like, oh, I have to stop. Like 200 is Tony back in the armor. And again, I've read this run like multiple times. And I knew what was going to happen. I remembered all the issues, but still I was like completely sucked in. I'm like, all right, I'm going to read this. So that was pretty cool. This particular issue is not my favorite of the run by any stretch of the imagination. It's okay. Again, I have fond memories of this, this run, despite the Luke McDonald art. I think it's fine. But like I was mentioned earlier, when Aiken and Garvey come on, I think it's even better. But as far as this issue, yeah, it's solid. It's Jim Rhodes. He's starting to kind of get the hang of the armor, and that goes kind of up and down over the next 20 issues leading up to 200 and everything. But, liked a lot of what Denny O'Neil was doing. I honestly, before, I read this to do this podcast, I'd forgotten that it was a Denny O'Neil who did this run, even though I do like this run so much. There's one complaint I hear about this era of Iron Man. So the whole reason Jim Rhodes is in the armor is because Tony has fallen back into alcoholism. You know, there's that famous demon in the bottle Iron Man storyline where Tony loses control just from being basically a drunk. And I think one of the knocks on this run is that some people say, well, it's super derivative. Denny O'Neil's just basically stealing from David Michelinie and Bob Layton when they did the original, you know, kind of like been there, done that with Tony Stark. Can we move on? But I kind of thought I didn't mind it. I thought it you know, it made sense. You know, we hear about people who suffer from alcoholism are, you know, easily able to fall off the wagon. So, and the way that that Denny O'Neil did it, I thought it was fine. I thought it made for some interesting stories, and it, you know, that Iron Man 200 is in my mind an iconic issue, and it was great to see Tony overcome his, you know, quote unquote demons, and get back in the armor. So, yeah, I think it was fine what O'Neil did. As far as the way this issue ties into Secret Wars, much like Captain America, it makes a little more sense. It's not quite as obvious of a tack on, but it's also only a page, you know. Jim gets back from defeating Mandarin and flying back from China, talks to a friend, finds out there's some weird contraption in Central Park, you know, same one we saw in the Avengers. He flies over there, he walks in, he disappears, and we get the message to be continued in Marvel Superhero Secret Wars #1 on sale soon, followed by that house ad that we were talking about so much in the last episode. So yeah, not doesn't tie in, you know, within the story like we saw in Spider-Man and X-Men and New Mutants. but we definitely know something's coming because it's not like some of the other Avengers issues that we saw where it was easily missed that it was even a tie-in at all. You know, Jim Rhodes, Iron Man, walks into the contraption and disappears, so clearly we know something's up. What do you have to add, Manny?
Not much. I think we covered the issue. I mean, it was an enjoyable issue. I can, even though I haven't read any of the other Iron Man books, it was easy to follow. It was easy to see where Rhodes was as far as using the Iron Man suit. I can tell that, you know, that he's pretty new to it. And then with the panels with Tony, I can tell like, oh, okay, that's where he is. He's battling alcoholism. And so, for being the end of a story, it was well written to kind of give me an idea of what was going on. So even though we're just using this for chronology purposes, it just kind of gave me an idea of where we are in the timeline as far as who's using the Iron Man suit and for what. So that thought was good. And then, that's all I had to add.
Yeah. And I just looked up, just did a quick Google search for, Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, for images, and on the cover. So that house ad that just about every comic fan has ever seen, that's the cover by Mike Zeck from, Marvel Superhero Secret Wars #1. And there is no Kitty Pryde. They removed her, didn't replace her with anybody, but she's definitely not on the, on the front cover. So yeah, she did not go to Battle World. So, I'd be interested. I'm going to share with you a couple of, later issues of Iron Man with Aiken and Garvey on, the inks over, McDonald, and see if you think it's better or worse or what your thoughts are. I'm curious to know about that. So, anyway, that's going to wrap it up for this Secret Wars Saturday. Hope you all enjoyed this trip down memory lane. I know I did. These were, being that, again, a huge long run on Iron Man. I think I started reading Iron Man in the 170s. And in the fact, like I said, it's one of my favorite runs. The next issue, 182, is another iconic cover. And it's Tony Stark. He's sitting in the snow in an alley in New York City in a blizzard, really, with, just a pants and a shirt on. And written on the walls behind him, it says, "In the morning, Tony Stark will be sober or he will be dead." And it's a really iconic cover. And it's kind of the turning point for Tony when he's at this low point in his life. But yeah, I started in the 170s for Iron Man and read up through 300 or so. So big long run on that. So, it was a good trip down memory lane. And like I said, I couldn't resist, reading those 20 issues. Didn't do the same thing with Captain America, but again, big long run on Cap. So, fond memories there as well. So I really enjoyed these two issues more so than a lot of the other, stuff that we've read, for the prelude to Secret War. So, I am looking forward to getting into the Secret Wars book itself because a lot more action in those. I mean, that story is pretty much nonstop action, so I can't wait to get into it. My only worry is that I've talked it up so much, and being that it's such a famous storyline, that Manny's ultimately going to be disappointed because it's not going to be able to live up to the hype because he's been hearing about it for years. So
that's one of their most iconic series ever. So,
it's still written, in the 80s. So you got to take it with a grain of salt.
Well, yeah, I know, but I try to kind of tone it down a bit and not, judge it for what it is for the book of its, for its era and kind of, especially like when we do, the Top Cow Chronology Project and those 90s books, like, holy cow. Yeah. but 80s, just the 80s books, they're so much more. They're all imaginative and whatnot, but just a little bit more of that
classic 80s pop culture feel that you know, that so many people grew up with, that, you know, superheroes that everybody loves and cares about, and Secret Wars was a big part of that. So,
oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's too bad you couldn't join me for the last couple of Top Cow chronologies. I managed to get through those Tomb Raider books, but
I was actually more upset I wasn't involved in last week's Secret Wars one, because that Hulk book was really good. And what was the other one? The Thing?
No, Thing's next week.
It was Hulk and...
Yeah, what was last week? Let me... Hold on, I'll tell you right now. It was Hulk... It was two Hulks. It was Hulk 293 and 294.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right. They make it to the Baxter Building and whatnot. Yeah, those are cool.
Yeah, the Baxter Building, and then... The next one was the one where Boomerang comes and kidnaps his girl.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was really good. Yeah, so those are good issues.
I wasn't reading Hulk at the time. Those were a little rough for me. Those weren't my favorite. They weren't terrible, but I much preferred the two books we read this week. So. All right, I think that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Please go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. You can do a search on Facebook and Instagram for The Comic Source and keep up to date on all our convention coverage and episodes. Twitter.com/TheComicSource is where you can find us on Twitter. Also, we're still doing our exclusive podcast every Tuesday, the 9-panel grid over at LRM Online. While you're there, check out all the other podcasts and articles on everything pop culture over at LRM Online. So thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.